Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm moving up in the world, did you notice? It's still hot. So I usually sit down here, but I thought that might be a little uncomfortable for the folks in the front row. Yes. Yeah, well, watch the Bible, okay? Yep. Well, it's so good to have these ladies and gentlemen to visit with us. Pastor called them young folk, and you're all young folk as far as I'm concerned, but I understand what he means by that. He's the oldest one here, so he can do that. But there is no disgrace to being young. If you're not young, you don't get a start in the world, do you? And so we've all been there if we're here. Well, we've been studying in Isaiah, and again, it's good to have Hope Krimmel with us this morning. Hope she stays around for a long while. And all of you, I think the rest of you are just supposed to be here. We'll probably, I don't know if we'll have any more this morning or not. Got some out. And happy Father's Day to the fathers. It is unfortunate for Pastor Bailey that he doesn't get to preach on Father's Day, because I'm sure that would be interesting, but maybe he'll hold it over till another Sunday or something like that.
I'll be working on it the whole year.
The whole year. Okay, so fasten your seatbelt next time it comes around. So we're in Isaiah 33 this morning, and we have an Isaiah with us today. So glad to have Isaiah Rodriguez. And I heard him talking ahead of time. There's all sorts of connections. One of the consequences of living a long time is that it's hard not to be able to make connections with somebody new. When you start talking, it's like, oh, you know them, or you're related to them. And of course, my wife is really good at that. I often say she knows everybody and where they live, but she doesn't like for me to do that, so I won't. Anyway, Isaiah. Isaiah was hugely impacted by the invasion of the Assyrians during his day. We've seen him use those events as sort of a backdrop for a number of his writings already in Isaiah. And in order to follow some of the metaphors and the images that he creates, you really have to be sort of in touch with what was going on in his world. Just to sit down and read Isaiah like it was a piece of literature without any kind of reference to what was going on leaves you scratching your head a lot. You don't see what's happening, what's going on. And so just briefly to review some of the things that are likely most connected to what he's going to be talking about in this chapter. The leader of the huge Assyrian Empire, who was Sennacherib at this point, had just invaded, I say just, several years in the making, invaded the coastal region of which Israel was part, and they were steadily advancing toward Jerusalem. And they were brutal. Anybody who had rebelled against them didn't get the chance to do it twice, and lost the chance usually in a very painful and torturous manner. Hezekiah, who was the king of Judah during this period, had rebelled against Sennacherib. When I say rebelled, he just quit sending him taxes, right? That's what that amounted to. And however, when he ended up on his doorstep in besieging Lachish, Hezekiah said to himself, maybe that was a bad idea, right? And so he sent word to Sennacherib and said, I've been a bad boy. What do I owe you? I'll pay whatever you say. And Sennacherib says, oh, I don't know. What was it? 30 talents of silver, 300 talents of silver, 30 talents of gold, something like that. Millions of dollars. And so Hezekiah proceeded to strip all the gold out of the palace and out of the temple and send it to him. And lo and behold, Sennacherib took it and proceeded to invade Jerusalem. Now, imagine what's going on in your mind if you're a part of the population or if you're a Hezekiah. You see this ominous threat, which is totally liquidating the world, and you see a way maybe to avoid it. Okay, we'll pay up, right? What do we owe you? We'll pay. And you pay, and they act like nothing happened. Sounds like the government, doesn't it? but anyway, that's what he experienced. And so now, lo and behold, Sennacherib is on his doorstep. And Hezekiah is going to Egypt trying to find allies. And Isaiah is saying, you know, what you need to do is you need to trust in the Lord. You need to call on God. Because he's the only one that can save you. And that just didn't seem like very good advice, you know. But it turned out it was great advice. God did save Jerusalem at this point in time. And this particular chapter, chapter 33, we have Isaiah looking at what has happened, looking into the future, and making comments on the whole thing. And one thing that you really have to work with in your mind when you read Isaiah is you say, okay, Isaiah is a book of prophecy, right? And prophecy tells you what's going to happen. Well, not exactly. If you look at prophecy only that way, you're going to be muddled a lot. In general, I would say, you know, prophecy doesn't tell us everything that's going to happen, but it tells us that God knows what's going to happen. He's in control. He knows. And so I don't read prophecy to figure out the future. I read prophecy to remind myself that God knows. And furthermore, when you have a book of the prophets, it's much more than just foretelling the future. It's often a commentary on the present or the past, includes the future. Anyway, in verse 1 here of chapter 33, we have the last in a series of six woes that Isaiah delivers in this section of his book. And he says, woe to thee that spoilest, and thou wast not spoiled, and dealest treacherously, and they dealt not treacherously with thee. When thou shalt cease to spoil, thou shalt be spoiled. When thou shalt make an end to deal treacherously, they shall deal treacherously with thee. Okay, so spoil here, of course, is a reference to the most attractive aspect of warfare. Why do kingdoms rise against other kingdoms and try to defeat them? Because they want their stuff. They want to take all the good things that they have so laboriously labored to extract from the earth and the ground. All the produce, all the clothing, all the gold and silver and precious things. That's the spoil of war. And it is worth fighting for in many people's minds. And so here Isaiah looks at the Assyrians. And at this point in time, nobody could stand up against them. They were invincible. They were steamrolling every kingdom. There were kingdoms that would actually give up and run before they got there rather than fight them. And so Isaiah pronounces woe on them, even though they have been successful. Treachery, oh yes, they knew about treachery. Hezekiah had witnessed that firsthand. And Isaiah condemns that as well. He says in verse 2, O Lord, be gracious unto us. We have waited for Thee. Be Thou their arm every morning, our salvation also in the time of trouble. So we read the first few verses last week of this chapter, and I mentioned that in this verse in the King James, we have this odd sequence of pronouns. Now, I don't think Isaiah was struggling with his pronouns like we are nowadays, but he goes from from their arm to our salvation, right? And so that's kind of an odd sequence. Some translations just gloss over it and make it all the same. The commentator, Alec Moitcher, says perhaps this is actually a little snippet of a worship sequence from liturgy, so that we have the leader saying, be thou our arm every morning, and the response of the people, be their arm every morning, the response of the people, our salvation also in the time of trouble. We don't know for a fact, we don't have a copy of their book of liturgy, but it is plausible, and it is in fact a part of the original text, so to just ignore it is probably not the best thing in terms of translation. But an appeal to God, we have waited for Thee. The strength of the arm is referred to here. You don't find armless soldiers fighting battles. If you don't have an arm, the only thing you can do is run. And that doesn't tend to win the war. So the arm is incredibly important. At the noise of the tumult, the people fled. At the lifting up of thyself, the nations were scattered. And your spoil shall be gathered like the gathering of the caterpillar. Okay, so in this image here that Isaiah is creating in your mind, he's pronounced woe on the Assyrians. And now he says, O Lord, be thou our salvation. And furthermore, he projects God as the army that is going to be invading. And he says the response to your invasion will be a total disintegration of all resistance. The people fled. The nations were scattered. Your spoil was gathered like the gathering of the caterpillar. As a running to and fro of locusts shall he run upon them. And we don't typically, I think, in this part of the world, personally experience the invasion of locusts. But if you've ever seen any pictures, it's pretty devastating. It's just like they're everywhere. And you may scare them off of one little area, but you walk over here and they're coming in behind you, right? And it's just, it's horrible. It really is. And so he pictures that, where do you hide your stuff from a locust? You know, where do you hide your plants? Well, not under a bush, that's for sure. it's a frightful thought. And he uses powerful images like that to communicate things. He says in verse 5, the Lord is exalted, for he dwelleth on high. He hath filled Zion with judgment and righteousness. And I always note, whenever you see the word judgment, you need to think of justice. In English, quite often when we talk about judge and judging and judgment, it's all negative, right? Don't do that. Don't be a judge. Don't be judgmental. But everybody wants justice, right? And when the prophets speak of judgment, sometimes they're referring to God's justice on evil, which is a very dark thing. But often they are talking about God's justice for all men. It's a very positive thing. And even judgment on evil is a positive thing if you're on God's side, right? So don't, in your mind, think negative about the word judgment when you read it in the prophets. It's a positive thing. He hath filled Zion with justice and righteousness. And wisdom and knowledge shall be the stability of thy times and strength of salvation. The fear of the Lord is his treasure. Okay, so we're reading King James here, and I often do that first. I was raised with that, and that's what's most familiar to me. But sometimes it's helpful to look at another translation. So in this particular verse, the Complete Jewish Bible renders it, he will be the stability of your times, a wealth of salvation, wisdom, and knowledge, and fear of Adonai, which is his treasure. Okay, so I like the way that flows, and verse 6 in the King James is a little bit fragmented. It says, and wisdom and knowledge shall be the stability of thy times and strength of salvation. And you're left with, well, why is that separated out? Why is that a separate thing? But none of the other translations that I found did it quite like that. And so I think probably the three of them are to be considered together. Salvation, wisdom, and knowledge. Okay, let's think about those things for a moment. Let's start with the last one, knowledge. Wow, now there's something that's important. It's important in life to know stuff. In all sorts of ways, you're going to get yourself in situations in life where you need to know things. If you are out on the highway going from one service to the next and your van breaks down, you want to know stuff. At least you want to know how to call somebody that knows stuff, right? And who are you going to call? Even that takes knowledge. If you've had some experience on the road, you know that there are certain types of establishments you want to stay a long ways from when it comes to help. And there's certain, I don't know, little indicators. You know, when you call the number and somebody says, what you want? You probably ought to try somebody else. That's a good sign. But it takes knowledge to know that, you know. It takes some experience in knowing things. So knowledge is super important to we human beings, to our daily life. Something as simple as knowing what is good to eat and what's not. What is healthy and what's not. How to cope with the extremities of weather. Those are all basic things which we sort of pick up along the way, but they're essential to our survival. And likewise, in our survival spiritually, there is much that we need to learn, much that we need to know. What does it take to establish a relationship with God? What does it take to maintain it? What do we do whenever we find that we're where we shouldn't be in that relationship? Those are all aspects of our knowledge which are critical. And so a world, a community that is infused with knowledge, where knowledge is available, is a very wonderful thing. It seems in our world there's a struggle to even find out what is truly knowledge. You know, you've got real knowledge and fake knowledge, right? And there's some knowledge that you're not allowed to have because somebody doesn't like it. Well, knowledge is not political.
That's good.
You know, what's true is true. And it doesn't matter if you don't like it. It's still going to be true tomorrow. And even if you try to rewrite history, it's still true. So you can't really say too much about the importance of a city, a world, which is founded on knowledge. And when God's involved, you know you've got the kind of knowledge which is going to be permanent. One thing that has been fascinating to me over the years has been the history of science. Have you ever studied the history of science? Well, you know, science is knowledge, right? That's how we know, right? Well, it's quite interesting that what we know has changed in terms of science a whole bunch, even in your lifetime. Even in the past few years, there was a time when we knew that masks didn't work. And so don't wear them, right, against COVID. And then there was a time when we knew that, well, actually, it takes two masks to work, or maybe three, right? And we knew that because science had spoken, or somebody like that. But in a bigger picture, on the hard sciences, not just the political ones, what we thought we knew has over and over been overturned. I mean, there was a time when the most knowledgeable people in the world were persuaded that the Earth was the center of the universe and everything revolved around us. There were other times whenever the idea on that was the sun. And so we have changed radically in the past few hundred years on everything from what's the center of the universe to how an atom is composed and what it's composed of. And so our knowledge is always going to be fallible. It's always something that we need to re-examine. So many times we make mistakes based on what we think we know, right? And one of the most common excuses you hear from people who end up causing catastrophes is something which starts out with, but I thought, right? I didn't think. That one too. I'm not sure how that makes an excuse. It doesn't work very well at all. But, you know, I thought the key was off, or I thought the power was off. I thought this, I thought that. Well, whenever you're saying those things, you're expressing what's going on in your mind. You had made an assumption. And for you, assumption serves as knowledge at that moment, right? Well, your assumptions in life will get you in trouble a lot. So be careful of them. But what a world to live in that Isaiah speaks of here, a world that has its stability based on knowledge and not just our knowledge, but the knowledge of the Lord, the knowledge that He provides, the knowledge that He has established. You can depend on that kind of knowledge. And then beyond that, he talks of wisdom. And usually we think about wisdom as understanding how to use knowledge. Just the facts don't get you through many difficult situations in life. There is a methodology that we use to apply them, to use them to solve our problems. And that seems to dwell in the world of wisdom. I don't know if you've ever encountered somebody who is older, mature, who perhaps is a craftsman in his field and has had many years of experience. Well, that's the very picture of wisdom, right? So he faces some sort of difficulty in his line of work, and he understands the techniques necessary to apply the knowledge that he has to come to the successful conclusion of the matter. And that's something that we tend to, by nature, lack. I mean, you don't start out, you're not born with wisdom, unfortunately. It's not a gene, it's not in a pill, it takes experience. Fortunately, if we give ourselves to the pursuit of God and the knowledge of Him, He can give us wisdom. But He usually makes us learn it the hard way. So a world whose stability, and I don't know about you, but these concepts just resonate with me more and more in the days that we live in. Things that, I mean, you just wouldn't have imagined. Can you imagine in this country the situation being the case that people can just walk into a Walmart and load up a buggy and walk out and nobody does anything about it? That's not stability. That won't work forever, by the way. Walmart's eventually empty. Stability. That's something that we sort of assume. That's something that we think is just a part of civilization. Well, it's not necessarily. It's not necessarily the way that human beings behave. In fact, it's not the way human beings behave unless there's some disciplining force brought into their life, either through force of law or through force of the moral demands of God on their heart and mind. That ultimately is what brings a stable civilization. So knowledge, wisdom, and he says also the strength of salvation. And I think that reflects on the simple matter that we as human beings, that's something we need. No matter how innocent we start this life as a child, we manage to get ourselves in messes, right? I know you mothers and fathers, this being Father's Day, have experienced or certainly will experience the time when the child shows up in a mess. And whether they're covered from head to toe in honey or whether they've spilled the flour or what they've done, it's somebody help me, right? I got a problem here. They need saving. They need salvation from that situation. Well, we chuckle about it when it's kids, but mercy, what God has to deal with when it's human beings, adults, who the messes they get themselves in are tragic and sad and difficult to fix. And yet Isaiah here recognizes that role of God in providing our salvation and the importance that is in the stability of a nation. And then he ends that particular series with the fear of the Lord. And notice here, it's the pronouns again. The fear of the Lord is His treasure. I am not a Hebrew scholar, and so I have to rely on others for this. But my understanding is that the way that's gendered, that can't refer to the city, and seems to refer to God. The fear of the Lord is His treasure. And so that's sort of an interesting thing to reflect on. We know from other passages how important proper regard for God is. Fear, reverence, awe, to respect Him as He really is central. It's the beginning of wisdom. And so quite often the prophets looked at the world around them and said, look, your problem is you don't fear God. You don't know who it is you're dealing with. You don't know what you're up against. You need to wise up here. Here again, we have Isaiah pointing to this central theme and referring to it as God's treasure. It's as though He were giving you the treasure of the proper respect for Him. So that's something to think about, isn't it?
Well, there is that. You know, if you're dealing with electricity and you don't have a proper respect for it, it will be a problem for you. Mm-hmm. And we're dealing with, when we interact with God and we all must at some point. We're dealing with something much more powerful than electricity.
Mm-hmm. That's a great example. And I fairly often have to deal with high voltages of some of my equipment, 480 volts. And I try to always make a practice of reminding myself, you know what? That looks totally innocuous. It's not bothering you a bit right now. But if you touch it, it will. And so you kind of plan. You don't do things instinctively. You plan your actions. You plan the movements so that they're intentional. Same thing applies with many of the machines. We work in the woodworking business, and I was thinking this week as I was routing some boards for rocking chairs that got this router bit on the table, and you hold the board, the arm in this case, and move around that bit, and it makes a nice rounded edge on it. But if your hand happens to drop down on one side, it'll make a nice rounded edge out of your hand as well, your finger, and just that fast, without a blink. And so I reminded myself, don't get careless here. Think about your movements. Think about what you're doing. The discipline. See, when you fear something, it brings a discipline to your life, right? You don't just do what feels good or what comes instinctively. You think about it, you know? And so that all I see all that in my mind when I reflect on having a proper respect for God and who He is. And of course, I can't help but add the footnote, we have the incredible revelation through Jesus, His Son, that in spite of His awesomeness, in spite of His fearsomeness, He loves us. That's really kind of odd, you know? He wouldn't have to do that. But that does change everything, doesn't it? Yes.
Keith, before we move on to the next verse, thinking about the wisdom and knowledge, and the light example of that I've heard is, knowledge tells you that a tomato is a fruit. Wisdom tells you not to put it in a fruit salad. But as I was thinking about that, it's like, you know, lots of people, it's hard to convince them of something because they know. They have a knowledge. And so, well, I'm making a fruit salad. That's a fruit, isn't it? Yes, it is a fruit, but it doesn't go in there. But it's a fruit salad. This is a fruit. So to convey information to someone when, well, you're right, you know, legally that does qualify, but wisdom tells me not to.
Yes, I think that's a great example, although I wonder, is there somebody here that likes tomatoes and fruit salads? No. Always got to consider those kind, you know, there's always the smart aleck, well, have you tried it? Yeah. Yep. That's a good example.
That is a really good thing to think about, because it's so easy as humans to slip into a legalistic mindset of, mm-hmm. well, there's no rule against this, and this fits, you know, in this little box or this uh-huh. pattern. It's like, right, but is it good? Is that uh-huh. is that what good are you going to bring into your life and to the lives of others by taking this freedom?
So talking about wisdom here. Yes. Yeah.
Uh-huh. It's interesting how it develops over life, too. You go from completely ignorant of everything, and then you start getting knowledge. Uh-huh. And it's usually somewhat later in life that you start getting wisdom of life.
Yes.
And the example of sort of what Julia was saying is that knowledge start setting you off.
Uh-huh. So you learn that gasoline is flammable, and that it will explode. Then you think, well, maybe I could use this to change a tire. Sorry, inside joke from the pastor. Doesn't work that well. It worked, did it?
Yeah, once.
Once? anyway, wisdom suggests that there are better methods and better uses for gasoline.
Well, there's an employee who ran out of gas, and he bought some gas and poured it in his car and smoking cigarettes at the same time. Now he got an experience.
Uh-huh.
You don't do that.
You don't do that.
That's
yeah.
That wasn't an employee. That wasn't a member.
Okay. Okay, so wisdom, it comes with life and life experiences. So then Isaiah, we sort of have to immerse ourselves back in his world in order to continue to follow his line of thinking here. And so I'll read these verses first. Behold, their valiant ones shall cry without, the ambassadors of peace shall weep bitterly. The highways lie waste. The wayfaring man ceaseth. He hath broken the covenant. He hath despised the cities. He regardeth no man. Okay, I'm going to pause there. I think the picture that he's describing here are some of the sort of... Isaiah does slideshows, okay? He thinks he's click, 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 and then presents them to you. For instance, here verse 8, imagine what the countryside is like whenever it is awaiting the impending invasion of hundreds of thousands of Assyrians. Are people out traveling? No. The highways are deserted. And I can really relate to that because here in 2020, whenever we were under all the lockdowns and everything, I was selling a product which was still capable of being sold because I was selling to essential businesses. And we made some trips across the country. And we went to places like, I remember one time we stayed in Nashville, Tennessee, out by the Grand Ole Opry area. And we were nearly the only person in the motel. It was easy to get reservations. We stayed in Louisiana when we were the only person in the motel. And so whenever you have these kind of events that are shaking the world up, these threats, we have the highways lie waste, the wayfaring man ceaseth, except for the idiots like us that didn't know any better. That people aren't out doing business as normal. Then he goes to the broken covenant. So there was at least an implied covenant in the interaction between Hezekiah and the king of Sennacherib, where Sennacherib sets his price. You know, if you're Hezekiah and you send word, what do I owe you? You know, what do I have to pay? And he gives you a number. The implication is, you give me this, and I'll back off, right? And so Isaiah decries the treachery, the brokenness of covenant involved there. Despise cities? Yes, he most certainly did despise cities. He laid them waste. He regardeth no man. The earth mourneth and languisheth. Lebanon is ashamed and hewn down. Okay, and so Lebanon is symbolic of what is always the case, what is always there. The great timbered lands of Lebanon in the ancient world were the source of building materials for many generations. And so people couldn't imagine that particular majestic area being all cut down. They couldn't cut them all. There were so many trees. And so to say that Lebanon is ashamed and hewn down is to suggest that the world is coming to an end. Sharon is like a wilderness. Heard of the Rose of Sharon? Sharon was known for its beauty. and Bashan and Carmel for their fruitfulness. They shall shake off their fruits. So, Isaiah here giving you this slide series of these different images depicting the terror that the Assyrians have afflicted on the earth. Verse 10, "Now will I rise, saith the Lord. Now will I be exalted. Now will I lift up myself." Okay, so God comes on the scene. We got scene two. And he says, "You shall conceive chaff. You shall bring forth stubble." And that's not a compliment. When you think about all the effort that farmers go to, especially in the ancient world, to grow something, you do it for one reason. It's because when it's all said and done, you get something back which is wonderful, which is edible, which is sustaining, which is great. You end up, when it's all said and done, what's left over is the chaff. Nobody wants that, particularly, unless you're making bricks. And so, when he says, "You shall conceive chaff," what a horrible thought. All the work, in this case, thinking of it in terms of conception, all the horrible work and literal labor of bringing forth a new life that's involved in conception and delivery, and to only bring forth chaff, I think ladies would say no thank you, right? That's not what we're looking forward to. And with the farmers, just to bring forth stubble. Furthermore, he says, "Your breath as fire shall devour you." Your very breath will cause you to self-ignite. Actually, it's more, I think, thinking about what comes out of their mouth, the words. And you can probably readily think of people that you have encountered perhaps in your life that do regularly self-ignite by what they say. "And the people shall be as the burnings of lime." Okay, so this is a picture of the intensity of heat. In order to create mortar to build structures, they took limestone and burned it at very high temperatures to drive off all the water. So you could take it and mix it with water, and it would become hard again as mortar. But it took a lot of energy to do that, a very complete fire. And so the people shall be as the burnings of lime, not much left. "As thorns cut up shall they be burned in the fire." So all these images, here again, I think to appreciate them, you have to sort of immerse yourself in the world of Isaiah. These aren't things that we encounter, maybe ever, maybe have never even heard of until we start researching them. But these would be powerful images in the minds of this generation, of these people listening. Okay, we've got a few minutes left here. Verse 13, he says, "Hear, ye that are far off, what I have done." And implied, "Hear, ye that are near, acknowledge my might." The sinners in Zion are afraid. Fearfulness hath surprised the hypocrites. Who among us shall dwell with the devouring fire? Who among us shall dwell with everlasting burnings? Okay, so he has transitioned into a picture here where he envisions Jehovah as this fire, this devouring fire. And he has these sinners of Zion posing this question. Are we going to be comfortable here? Do we want to live here with this kind of awesome presence? he has noted the importance of the fear of the Lord in verse 6. Well, in this verse, he's depicting people who are becoming conscious of God's awesomeness, who see him as a devouring fire, as an everlasting burning. And they are worried whether or not this is going to be a good place to stay. Maybe we better move on. An interesting thought. But he answers the question that they ask. They ask, who shall dwell among dwell with the devouring fire? Verse 15, he that walketh righteously and speaketh uprightly, he that despiseth the gain of oppressions, that shaketh his hands from holding of bribes, that stoppeth his ears from hearing of blood, and shutteth his eyes from seeing evil, he shall dwell on high. In other words, with God. In verse 10, he says, the Lord is exalted. He is on high. But his place of defense shall be the munitions or the fortifications of rocks. Bread shall be given him. His waters shall be sure. Okay, so we have here a very concise statement of what kind of people are going to be comfortable in the presence of God with this devouring fire, this everlasting burning. And the answer is those that walk righteously. It makes a difference in life. How you conduct your life. How do you walk? This metaphor of walking is often used in Scripture to describe our general conduct in life. It's not just about how we move across the room, but how we traverse life, how we conduct ourselves. Unfortunately, much of the Christian world, at least in Christian in name, has really forsaken a basic understanding that if you're going to be able to dwell in the presence of this consuming fire, you're going to have to walk uprightly. It's shocking when you really become aware of the number of people in the world who truly believe that everybody is destined to sin, not just sometime in their life, but consistently in their life. In fact, continually in their life. And I really fear for them, because when you settle in your mind that that's just how things are and how things are going to be, it seems you have lost your sense of the fear of God. It's like you're telling God, this is how you made me, this is how I'm going to be, get used to it. And fortunately, you love me, and so you don't have any choice. You've got to accept me like I am. I wonder if God enjoys being told that his love is unconditional. Well, it depends on what you mean by that. We certainly don't earn his love. It's not conditional in that sense. And it's also not conditional in the sense that he wants us to be his child no matter where we've been. But in terms of ongoing relationship, no sane human is happy with a relationship which doesn't have reciprocity, that doesn't have response, that doesn't have respect, that doesn't have fidelity. And yet somehow we have dictated that, well, that's how God is, that's how he must be, and that's how I'm going to treat him. I think Isaiah would say that the sinners in Zion are afraid, and that fearfulness has surprised the hypocrites, because they're worried about dwelling with this devouring fire. They've gotten a picture of him. They've got a view of him. which is burning in their mind. And his response is to them, he answers for them, it is he that walketh righteously and speaketh uprightly. He that despises the gain of oppressions. Instead of looking at the opportunities, I should say the tragedies of life as opportunities, as our modern political class does. You know that phrase, you don't ever want to let a crisis go to waste. Rather, he says, they despise the gain of oppressions. And that's hard for human beings to do. If there's a way to get gain in a situation, it's like, oh, this might turn out pretty good after all. Right? Looks like a problem? No problem. I'm going to gain here. Well, you can be of such a mindset that you determine, I'm going to despise that kind of gain. I'm going to reject it. I'm going to refuse it as a gain in my life. And so there's a lot to be said here about verse 15.
Keith,
but
the
yes.
Phrase that stoppeth his ears from hearing blood.
Uh-huh.
What does
that mean? So that seems to be a reference to plotting to overthrow, to plotting against somebody to produce blood. So the hearing is in the refers to that activity that yes, is a human activity, plotting your opponent's downfall. Anyway, as I say, there's much to be said there, but I'm out of time to even say anything more about that. So I will take a rain check. Thank you all for listening attentively. And we are ready for the next part of this service. And so we will move the furniture a little bit and turn it over to the group from Penview who have traveled all the way from Kansas to be with us today. Kansas? Yes, Kansas. Thank you.